My name is Julian Koo, and I'm a professor of law at Hofstra Law School, and I'm going to moderate this panel for panel number three, Constitutional Prudential Limits on the Treaty Power, Federalism, Delegation, or Some Other Principle. And I want to thank all of you for sticking it out through the day to all the different events that have happened here and for staying for this panel. I want to promise to do my best to make it worth your time. We have done so by gathering a panel of very distinguished and, more important than distinguished, very interesting scholars who will discuss the legal issues related to international agreements made by the United States. The importance of this topic might be debatable. It's not hard for me to see, as we sit here at the beginning of year two, of what could be, potentially, one of the more internationalist U.S. administrations in the past 40 years. And certainly served by one of the most brilliant, but also one of the most, I think, internationalist or transnationalist State Department legal advisors, my old professor Harold Coe, in this sort of combination of folks could be potentially a lot of activity in the international agreement area for the United States, and certainly during this current administration. Still, this is too large a topic to handle even in the time we've allotted, so we're going to focus our discussion in two ways. First, we're going to concentrate on two of the most important of the many difficult legal issues arising out of international agreement making by the United States. One, we'll focus on the use of international agreements to delegate power, U.S. government power, to international organizations and institutions. And second, we're going to discuss the effect domestically of international agreements on U.S. constitutional principles of federalism and general state autonomy in the United States. So we'll focus on those two issues for the most part. And second, I've asked my panelists to be somewhat forward-looking, to try to offer a little bit of predictive claims about how the doctrines that we'll talk about will evolve, rather than simply the normative claims that that we often make in these contexts. But we're going to definitely offer those normative claims as well. before we go to the panelists, I want to situate our discussion a little bit by providing some background. The United States is party to literally thousands, for all I know, tens of thousands, of international agreements. It's fair to say that the pace of international agreement making is not likely to slow down in the next decade. I believe this reflects the continuing globalization of economic, social, and political activity, which has accelerated since the end of the Cold War. What's more interesting, to me at least, than the number of international agreements is the nature and scope of contemporary international agreements. As we'll discuss today, modern international agreements seek to encourage and indeed require a much deeper political integration and cooperation than in the past. Second, international agreements are no longer just bilateral agreements, but they often are huge, humongous multilateral agreements with more than 100 states, which seek to require the member states to comply with a complex set of rules and regulations. And so to give one relatively uncontroversial example, the World Trade Organization has over 100 members, has the authority to determine whether member states like the United States are in compliance with their obligations under the WTO agreements, and to demand that the United States comply with those obligations. The nature of those obligations are hardly obvious from the text of the agreements themselves and requires administration and interpretation by WTO institutions. Now, in recent years, scholars in the United States have identified this process of delegating authority to international institutions as international delegations, and this can encompass any kind of transfer of federal power. We could transfer the power to decide cases under the law. This would be the transfer of judicial power. To administer or execute U.S. law, that would be perhaps the power to execute U.S. law under the Appointments Clause, perhaps, or to make rules, legislative power. And as our panelists will explain, international delegations, where they might disagree, they are at least a potentially important phenomenon, and they're even a real phenomenon. It's not obvious how the U.S. system will respond to this. The first effort by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Medellin versus Texas in 2007 dealt with an ICJ interpretation of a U.S. treaty obligation, which were claimed to be binding on the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is the first effort by the U.S. system to try to deal with these kinds of delegations. The second big trend in international agreements, I'm going to argue, is the broader scope of their subject matter. Modern international agreements seek to regulate a wider set of topics, say more than just diplomatic rights or say peace treaties, etc. Now we have treaties regulating international human rights, private law, including commercial law, family law. If those of you who watch the Today Show could follow the travails of the American father from New Jersey who was trying to get his son back from Brazil, and he invoked his treaty rights through a 10-year or 5-year litigation to do it. It's a classic example. Now we have treaties regulating areas of domestic relations. So I think this means that in the U.S. context, we have treaties now that we could sign or have signed that regulate matters that were traditionally or even constitutionally required to be left to the state governments. And this has created tensions, especially as there's been at least a mild, if not a robust, revival of federalism by the courts and in the public sphere over the past 20 years. But there's been, at the same time, a strong effort to create and have the U.S. join many of these new, very ambitious international treaty regimes. Now, the Obama administration came into office with a distinctly internationalist orientation, by which I mean a strong commitment to international legal institutions. And the president himself has chaired a meeting of the United Nations Security Council, has instructed the U.S. to rejoin the UN Human Rights Council. He's signed the Convention on Disabilities, and he has pledged to submit or advocate for the completion of human rights treaties like the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the Law of the Sea Treaty, and among other treaties. And he has also made some noises about closer cooperation with the International Criminal Court. And so I think that, and most importantly, I think, he's appointed sub-cabinet officials of very high stature and internationalist orientation that are likely to advocate for greater use of international legal institutions. Many of you know the State Department legal advisor Harold Coe, the former dean of the Yale Law School, is a well-known legal scholar who, in his work, has advocated the greater integration of international law into the domestic U.S. legal system. A less well-known in this crowd, probably, State Department's Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, Michael Posner, is a former chief of Human Rights First, which is a non-governmental organization formerly called the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which is also famous and has focused its advocacy on the integration and compliance of international legal norms with the U.S. system. So I don't think that, at least even if they necessarily haven't accomplished a lot of the policies, the general orientation of the administration is greater reliance and interest in international institutions and international legal, international agreements, perhaps, than prior administrations. So, and even beyond the current politics of today, I think there's reason to think the trend toward more international agreements requiring more delegations and a further shrinking of state autonomy, given the subject matter of modern international agreements, all of this is likely to continue. So the question for our panelists is how and whether U.S. constitutional norms will affect or accommodate this trend. At least that's one of the questions I'm going to pose to them. So our panel today consists of three very, as I said, distinguished but also interesting scholars who will discuss some of these issues for us. We'll start with John McGinnis, who is a Stanford Clinton professor of law at Northwestern School of Law. And then we'll proceed to David Sloss, who's the professor of law at Santa Clara University Law School and the director of the Center of Global Law and Policy there. And then finally, we'll hear from Professor Duncan Hollis of the Beyalzi School of Law at Temple University, and then I'll offer some comments on my own and questions for them for each of the panelists after their presentations. So we'll start with Professor McGinnis. Let me just say a couple more words and with each panelist. John doesn't really need much of an introduction for this crowd, I think, or actually anywhere in the Legal Academy. He's a leading scholar and important voice in the fields of constitutional law, foreign relations law, international trade law, international law, and some other areas I don't know myself, but I'm sure he is. His latest article, The Future of International Delegations, was published in 2009 by the Yale Law Journal, and will probably no doubt part form of our conversation today. So, John?
Well, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. I am going to talk about the future of international delegation here, and following Julian's lead, I'm going to talk about some of the reasons that I think we are going to see more intense concern about international delegations. First, going to describe the problems quite generically and in some sense pragmatically, and then suggest actually our our 18th century constitution may have a kind of solution to the problem of international delegations in the treaty power and its substantial requirements for ratification of a treaty, i.e. getting two-thirds of the Senate. So why might we see, first of all, pressure for international delegations in the future? I think this is really an old story. Acceleration of technological change and the interconnections of the world create externalities among nations, and that's going to mean there's going to be a greater interest in coming to joint agreements about what law is. And precisely for the same reasons that we also then saw in the 20th century the rise of the domestic administrative state, because many of these issues, particularly issues like pollution, are very complicated and can not easily be resolved by legislatures, there'll be an interest in delegating matters. But delegating matters in this case, because they're international problems, to international actors, and then having them have their decisions have direct effect in various nations, including the United States, was, of course, the difficulty of waiting until having another whole agreement on giving them direct effect is their huge holdout problems. And so I think that's the reason we're going to see a movement of pressure for international delegations. Well, international delegations, just pragmatically, they have some real problems, I think, for democratic governance. And I think the way to see how acute they are is to compare them to domestic delegations, which also have substantial problems for democratic governance that are, I think, quite well understood. I think they can be summarized in two ways. One is what I would call the democratic deficit of delegation. These bureaucrats and agents, they're not democratically elected while they carry out their actions under the requirements of some statute. There's a lot of slack there. So that's one concern. Another concern, maybe even worse, from a public choice perspective, that members of the legislature and will be happy to reward special interest groups who will be able to better influence agents than they are the legislature. They'll recognize that they can distance themselves from their decisions and yet reward interest groups. And that's a well-known theory in the literature about why Congress delegates, why you want to excessively delegate, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. How do we deal with this in the domestic constitution? Well, I think the way we've dealt with it largely is to have substantial oversight through the president, through our own court system of delegations. Whether that's a complete answer is unclear. We've also have, I think, a requirement at least that Congress make it clear that it's making a delegation. Note that the first kind of response, that we're simply going to have the president oversee the delegation of authority, really isn't available in the international context. Moreover, in some sense, so this shows, I think, why the international context of delegation may be even more problematic. Another area that makes it more problematic is that it may be very difficult for the nations who are, of course, separate. It's a problem of multiple principles. Here, at least you can conceive of the principle as being the president, or at least being representing the people as the principal and disciplining the agents. We have multiple agents in the international context, and that means, I think, that the problem of democratic deficit and of agency costs is more acute in the international context. So what possibly can we do about that? One possibility is you might think, well, if there's a big democratic deficit and we think there's maybe too much delegation because members would like to create a lot of agency costs and reward interest groups, is up front we could have something that I've worked on a lot with Mike Rappaport. We could have a supermajority rule disciplining that. We could, the democratic deficit means that right up front, it means that the stringent process for entrenching this provision in a constitution, we think, provides an analogy maybe to this. We require a big supermajority requirement up front, and that allows us to constrain current majorities. We're less worried about that, theoretically. Similarly, with respect to agency costs, the presence of high agency costs makes international delegations potentially costly, but the supermajority rule requires more support for international delegations, thus filtering out the delegations where the costs exceed their benefits, given that Congress isn't likely fully to perceive those costs to the people. So that's the argument. Many similar arguments actually been made in the domestic context of why we have a clear statement rule, is that's also a way of disciplining domestic delegations. So that's the argument why you actually might think that might be a kind of solution. Well, this gets me around, of course, to our 18th century constitution, because lo and behold, we do have a provision of the 18th century constitution that has a supermajority rule, and that's the treaty provision. It requires a supermajority for treaties to be made. And so in the small time I have left remaining, I'll defend two propositions. One, that you should not be, as a kind of originalist matter, be able to delegate direct effect. In other words, the power of some confederal or international power to have direct effect in the United States through statute, and you can do through treaty. And I'll just talk about this very briefly. First, with respect to statute, I think there are huge problems in just a statutory matter of delegation, and they come from the Appointments Clause and from Article 3, because ordinarily in our domestic system, we require the president to appoint agents with substantial power, and certainly with respect to judicial power, they have to go through Article 3. Of course, in international delegation, where we have international agents, that's really not going to work. And so that's the problem there. With respect to the treaty power, one wonders, well, then why? How does the treaty power help you? And I have a variety of historical arguments, and historical arguments are hard to rehearse, I think, in a brief way, in a talk such as this. And so let me just give you a hint of them. The basic argument is that the treaty clause answers the complaints under the Appointments Clause in Article 3. It agrees with the basic contention that international tribunals are operating under international or perhaps confederal law, as it would have been called at the time of the framing, but they can have nevertheless domestic effect, because that was understood to be an attribute of a treaty that was brought in over the transom into domestic law by the Supremacy Clause. And as evidence of this, I think we appeal to Alexander Hamilton. And he says, in fact, it was well understood that to give the power the most ample latitude, he's talking about the treaty power, to render it competent to all stipulations with the making of exigencies of the national affairs might require, competent making treaties of all kinds, alliance, treaties of commerce, treaties of peace, and every other species of convention usual among nations. Well, one convention that was possible among nations was a treaty of confederation, in which the center was able to have some direct effect on the states that joined it. And that isn't just an abstract point. The quote that I just read from Hamilton comes in the context of the Jay Treaty, which gave such a direct effect to a tribunal to settle certain debts of merchants. And some of these same complaints came up. Well, you can't give them the ability to make direct effect in the United States. And Hamilton answers this and says, in fact, it claims it. He says that he argued that the treaty power allowed you to establish within the country's tribunals otherwise unknown to our constitutions and law. So it's not only this abstract view. This actually was the controversy at issue in the case. For some more historical evidence, I think you can look to the Articles of Confederation itself. That was a treaty among the states, which gave a confederal power that bound some of the states. And in an article I'm working on, I'm looking at the way the confederal power of the Confederation bound the states. So that's the basic argument, that it's all right under the treaty power. And I'll say one other point and then subsist. One concern you might have generally about the structure of international delegations, looking at our current delegations, is they actually don't constrained. They don't have our structure of separation of powers, or even a comparable international structure of separation of powers that tries to protect against the large agency costs of international agents. One advantage of a high hurdle to get international delegations from the most powerful country in the world may be to give incentives to the international order to think about how, under international law, to put in the kinds of separation of powers structures and other constraints on agencies, because then we'll be more likely to ratify treaties with international delegations. So that's the why I don't want to all claim that this is the perfect solution, but I think, oddly enough, to a very pragmatic concern of the 21st century, I do think there may be an answer actually in the formal originalist understanding of a central part of our own constitution of the treaty power. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John. I'll have questions for you after that, but that's a great presentation. Next, we'll hear from Professor David Sloss. Prior to actually entering the legal profession, David served for many years at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, but since entering the legal academy, he's become one of the leading scholars on the treaty power and, at least in my view, the self-execution doctrine in general, which he'll be happy to talk with you about. Probably not here, but if you like, he'll can talk for hours and hours about self-execution. His latest work is actually, more broadly, a book on international law in the Supreme Court, which is forthcoming, an edited volume, forthcoming 2010?
Probably 2011.
Okay, forthcoming 2011. So, Professor David Sloss.
All right, thanks very much. Well, first I want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate in this panel today. Given the brief time available, I really want to make two points. First, I want to try and persuade you that the United States actually has a vital interest in being able to delegate authority to international institutions. And second, that under our Constitution, obligations that flow from those treaty-based delegations are directly binding on domestic, judicial, and executive officials. So to start, let's consider the likely structure of world politics in 2050, 40 years from now. It's a safe bet that the United States will not exercise the same degree of hegemonic power that we do today. China will be a more powerful state than it is now. We may well witness the rise of states like Russia, India, and Iran as global powers. The writing is on the wall. The era of the United States as the world's preeminent superpower will not last forever. As Chinese military and economic power increase, we will not be able to use American muscle to coerce China to conform its behavior to our wishes. However, if we use our current dominant position to strengthen international institutions, those institutions can exercise meaningful constraints on China and other rising powers. Therefore, I would argue, we have a vital national interest in enhancing the authority of existing international institutions or creating new institutions with the power to induce other states to comply with international norms. Now, as Professor McGinnis has noted, there are certainly downsides to vesting international institutions with greater powers. Any international institution that can pressure China to comply with international rules can also pressure the U.S. to comply with those same rules. By delegating authority to international institutions, we constrain China's freedom of action only insofar as we accept similar constraints on the United States. So to ensure that international delegations promote our national interests, we should focus on two factors. First, we want to ensure that the substantive rules applied by those international institutions are consistent with American values. Second, we need to think carefully about when to grant those institutions weak powers versus strong powers. And when I say strong powers, I'm thinking primarily of the power to issue decisions that bind the United States as a matter of international law. In sum, it is wise to proceed cautiously. But geopolitical forces are leading inexorably to greater delegations of authority. As U.S. economic and military power declines relative to other states, we will have greater incentives to delegate authority to international institutions so that those institutions can impose meaningful constraints on other states. Now, this raises an important question. What are the domestic consequences of joining treaties that grant authority to international institutions to issue decisions that are legally binding on the United States? In posing this question, I'm not asking about an ideal constitution. I'm asking about our existing constitution. And in addressing it, I will assume, and I'm sure this is something we'll come back to later, but I'll assume we're talking about valid treaties. In other words, treaties in which the initial delegation of authority to an international body does not violate any constitutional prohibitions. Here, the Supreme Court decision in Medellin deserves to be repudiated because it is fundamentally inconsistent with our existing constitution. The Constitution specifies that all treaties are the supreme law of the land. This means that all treaty-based legal obligations that bind the United States under international law create domestic legal obligations that bind domestic government officers, unless the treaty is constitutionally non-self-executing. A treaty is constitutionally non-self-executing if, and only if, it obligates the United States to take steps that lie within Congress's exclusive legislative authority under Article I. Now, here I want to mention two particular constitutional provisions. First, the Take Care Clause means that the president and federal executive officers have a constitutional duty to implement treaties. This constitutional duty applies to all treaties that impose binding international legal obligations on the United States, except for constitutionally non-self-executing treaties. Therefore, if a treaty obligates the United States to comply with the decision of an international tribunal, the president has a constitutional duty to implement that treaty obligation. In executing that duty, the president must act within the scope of authority granted him under the Constitution and other federal laws. The second key constitutional provision is Article 6, in particular that clause which specifies that judges in every state are bound by treaties. This means that state court judges have a constitutional duty to apply treaties. In every case where state law grants the court jurisdiction, if a treaty provides a specific rule that is binding on the United States and is applicable to a contested issue in that case. In my view, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals violated its constitutional duty when it refused to apply Article 94 of the UN Charter in Medellin. This interpretation I am advocating conforms to the founders' shared understanding of the Take Care Clause and the Supremacy Clause. Moreover, it was the consensus view that prevailed for almost two centuries. Indeed, the view I am describing was the consensus view of all government officials who participated in debates about the Bricker Amendment in the 1950s. And I can say more about that in Q&A if you want. Of course, Senator Bricker's attempt to amend the Constitution failed. Nevertheless, beginning in the 1960s, scholars and government officials reinterpreted the Constitution to mean what it would have meant if the Bricker Amendment had passed. Under this post-Bricker view, a treaty that imposes binding obligations on the United States under international law does not necessarily bind domestic government officers as a matter of domestic law. In my view, this post-Bricker attempt to amend the Constitution through creative reinterpretation is illegitimate. The only legitimate way to amend the Constitution is to use the Article 5 amendment process. absent a formal constitutional amendment, courts should interpret the Constitution in accordance with the consensus view that prevailed from the founding until the 1960s. To reiterate, that consensus view can be summarized as follows. Treaty obligations that bind the United States as a matter of international law create domestic legal obligations that bind all state courts under the Supremacy Clause and federal executive officers under Article II, who have the domestic legal authority to implement the treaty. And this rule applies to treaties that obligate the United States to comply with decisions of international tribunals in the same way that applies to other legally binding treaties. So I look forward to a lively discussion here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And finally, we'll shift gears and focus a little bit on the other issue I mentioned, which I think is an important future trend in international agreements for the U.S., and that's the scope of international agreements and their effect on federalism and principles of federalism in the U.S. system. And with that, we'll have Professor Duncan Hollis. Professor Hollis brings his experience as an attorney advisor at the State Department's Legal Advisor's Office to his scholarship on international legal issues. He's also published numerous articles on the treaty power and federalism, and in particular, its intersection with executive power. And most recently, he's published an article on has an article coming out in the Texas Law Review on state compacts and state international agreements. So, Professor Hollis?
Thanks, Julian. So let me first say thank you to the Federalist Society for having me. And Julian, to you specifically, because you suggested I focus on the future prospects for federalism-based limitations on the treaty power. And I'm very appreciative of that, because when it comes to past and present characterizations of how federalism fits into the U.S. treaty making, I have some issues. My first complaint is actually rather pedestrian. It's about volume. About how much one has to read to get a handle on this issue. The materials are extensive, going all the way back to the framing. Holmes's opinion in Missouri v. Holland purported to lay the issue to rest. There, of course, the court opined that the 10th Amendment did not limit the treaty power, and that Congress thus, under the Necessary and Proper Clause, could implement treaties beyond the scope of its own enumerated powers. But of course, Missouri didn't end the conversation. The Bricker Amendment that David Sloss just mentioned obviously was an example, and we've seen more recent scholarship following Kurt Bradley's call that Missouri be overturned in 1998. So like moths to the flame, foreign affairs lawyers cannot resist offering their own take, and almost everyone, although I think, John, you may be an exception, I don't know, but almost everyone, myself included, has felt the need to offer their scholarly take on the states' rights question. But the density of that debate aside, my real problem with the present posture of the federalism question lies with its focus. The debate now centers almost entirely on the doctrine, on the what I'll call the what question. What limits does the Constitution impose on the treaty power? Was Missouri right that the Constitution only requires U.S. treaty commitments to serve a national interest? Or might the Constitution limit treaties in matters of international concern, as Charles Evans Hughes once proposed? Or, as Kurt Bradley suggested, should Article I limit the reach of U.S. treaty making as much as it does U.S. lawmaking? Now, I'm not saying this what limits inquiry is unimportant. With the number of U.S. international agreements at, I think, Julian, actually 10,700 and counting, there's a persistent need to know what lines, if any, exist which U.S. treaty makers cannot cross. But after 200-plus years of debate, I'm just skeptical that further arguments on this subject are suddenly going to generate a consensus position in the future. Instead, I think if we're to talk about the future of federalism limits, the better question is not what, but who. Not what limits constrain U.S. treaty making, but who will invoke federalism as a brake on such treaty making. There are three prime suspects: the states, the court, Congress. And to that list, I want to add a fourth, less obvious candidate, and that's the executive. And so what I want to do with the rest of my time is briefly talk about which of these four actors is most likely to employ federalism or the rhetoric of federalism to constrain U.S. treaty making and the treaty power. And as I'll explain, perhaps somewhat surprisingly, my prediction is that it will be the executive that will self-impose federalism limits far more than any of the other actors I mentioned will try and impose federalism limits on the executive externally. Now, as for the states, in some ways they have the most at stake in this question, because it is the scope of their regulatory autonomy that is directly tied to this treaty power question. And certainly the states could act to protect their interests. After all, it was Missouri, the state of Missouri, that initiated the case in Missouri v. Holland. But I'm less sanguine that the states will take similar action in the future. Even as Julian described, treaties have proliferated, begun to regulate in areas traditionally within the sole province of the states, you haven't seen much complaints from the states themselves. It's scholars, not states, who've been complaining about the interference of the treaty power does to state rights. Moreover, I think states may actually not have a great interest in raising the federalism banner, as doing so might generate questions about their own recent activity. States in recent years have begun to conclude a rash of agreements with foreign national and subnational governments, notwithstanding the textual denial of a treaty power to the states, thereby making it maybe perhaps uncomfortable should we engage in a federalism conversation with the states directly. So if not the states, what about the court? Will the future bring judicial safeguards of federalism akin to those the Rehnquist Court imposed a la Lopez, Morrison, New York, and Prince? Here again, I think new doctrine is possible, but unlikely. Missouri remains a pretty venerable precedent, enjoying strong support in the court. Breyer, Ginsburg, Stevens, and Thomas have all joined opinions accepting Missouri, and the other justices have never shown any overt hostility towards it. Indeed, as a district judge, Sotomayor expressly rejected a Tenth Amendment limit on the hostage-taking treaties implementing legislation. Moreover, if the court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence is any sort of bellwether here, I think Raich did a lot to undermine the case that judicial cabining of the treaty power was somehow inevitable post-Lopez. Medellin perhaps might be of interest here, and I think though Medellin might have rejected the executive's ability in executing a treaty against the state of Texas, but it's interesting that in doing so, the majority suggested, a la the Missouri v. Holland case, that it was Congress that could implement the ICJ decision via legislation, even though the issue lay at, quote, the heart of the state's police powers. Finally, as a practical matter, I just don't think there's going to be that many opportunities in the future for the court to address federalism questions. As Peter Spiro first suggested, neither U.S. treaty makers nor Congress have actually relied on Missouri v. Holland to any great extent. Most modern treaties and implementing legislation actually comport with the legislative powers afforded Congress by Article I. Now, some see that as proof of Wexler's famous political safeguards of federalism idea, that the Senate in giving advice and consent to treaties or Congress in implementing them is going to be, is and has and will be protecting the states from any overreaching by the executive in its treaty making. And I'll admit that the legislature at times is sympathetic to states' rights and federalism concerns. But on the other hand, I just don't think there's that much evidence that the Congress is ready to adopt the primary role in invoking federalism. On the contrary, Congress still at times will rely on the treaty power to legislate outside of Article I. Most recently in 2007, it enacted a statute, 16 U.S.C. 1423, implementing a 2000 treaty between the United States and Russia on polar bears, and the statute makes it unlawful to kill polar bears in violation of the treaty's provisions, but the treaty only deals with subsistence take of polar bears. Killing polar bears for non-commercial purposes, therefore really without any link to interstate commerce. More importantly, though, when the Senate or Congress invoke federalism in some ways or accommodate federalism in some ways, I think it's really interesting that if you look beneath the curtain, so to speak, that they're almost always acting not on their own initiative, but at the behest of the executive branch. Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying the executive has or will decide definitively what the federalism limits are on U.S. treaty making. But it is clear that the executive has and likely will continue to have federalism play a role in its treaty making. In fact, I think you could look at what the executive's done and kind of divide its approach into one of three categories, either a category of no accommodation, a category of total accommodation, or some accommodation to federalism via negotiations, reservations, or understandings. So first, briefly, in terms of no accommodations, there are instances where the executive ignores federalism in U.S. treaty making. And it may be because it sees no valid federalism issue at stake, nuclear non-proliferation treaty, by way of an example. Or it may be because it's decided whatever interference the treaty will have in an area that the states otherwise regulate is outweighed by competing concerns with regulating transnational conduct of foreign nationals. So you get the Convention on the International Sale of Goods supplanting the UCC and other state laws for international contracts. Or you get a series of stolen vehicle treaties that basically require state officials to impound vehicles stolen abroad. But on the flip side, there are historically and at present a number of cases where the executive has totally accommodated federalism and decided not to join a treaty because it views that treaty to be in too great a tension with our federal structure. Used to be the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We'll talk about that probably more. The International Covenant on Economic, Cultural, and Social Rights might be a good example here. In between these polls, the executive has also demonstrated that they have another array of tools they can use to either avoid triggering federalism or at least mitigating federalism concerns in U.S. treaty making. So sometimes the executive will actually renegotiate text to ensure that the treaty obligations lie only at the national level and don't impose obligations on the states. We see that, for example, in the Tobacco Convention. Or the U.S. will sometimes negotiate what's called a federal-state clause. That is a clause that specifically exempts federal states from any obligations that would where competency lies at the sub-federal level. If it can't negotiate a fix, though, the executive has shown that it will, on occasion, impose one unilaterally. So, for example, the executive proposed a reservation to both the Transnational Organized Crime and the Corruption Conventions, invoking, quote, fundamental principles of federalism to reserve out of certain of the treaty obligations in areas that were traditionally regulated by the states, intrastate crime in both cases. Finally, in the human rights context, we've seen the executive propose understandings. That is, not changing what obligations the executive accepts, but issuing an understanding that says, given our federal structure, other parties, you need to understand we're going to implement this treaty both through federal authority and via state law. So, for example, in a treaty requiring the U.S. to prohibit child prostitution, the U.S. joined the treaty saying, we've surveyed all 50 states, every one of the states prohibits child prostitution, those state laws are sufficient for us to meet our international obligation. Now, I want to emphasize the approach the executive takes to what limits to impose and when to use these various categories changes over time. So today, for example, a treaty prohibiting the manufacture of nuclear weapons is unlikely to raise any federalism eyebrows. But a century ago, the U.S. regularly declined to join treaties on the manufacture of armaments because it believed that those issues lay solely within state jurisdiction. Similarly, Eisenhower said, we can't join human rights treaties because they're too much in tension with core state powers. But yet Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Clinton would all later support those exact same treaties, albeit with reservations and understandings like the ones I've described, although those reservations and understandings have attracted some controversy. I actually think it's too soon to tell, notwithstanding who sits in the various chairs, where the Obama administration is going to come out in terms of total accommodation, no accommodation, some accommodation. The Obama administration has only done three tax treaties and a treaty on Antarctica so far, so we haven't gotten any evidence of what sort of position they're going to take. But regardless of any shifts, my position is that it's going to be the executive that's going to be the one that takes into account and accommodates federalism far more likely than any of the other three actors I've mentioned. That has obviously some interesting structural implications. What does it mean for federalism when it's the executive that is internally producing restrictions or guidelines on federalism limitations? So, for example, when the executive says, oh, we didn't join the International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights because federalism would prohibit it, it's interesting because having done that, by not joining the treaty, the executive basically forecloses any of the other actors, the court or Congress, from second-guessing that assertion, and therefore it's allowed to construct its own view of federalism limits and the treaty power free from any other checks from the other branches. Interestingly, also, when the Senate goes ahead and accepts an executive proposal for a federalism reservation or an understanding, we actually have then a shared political branch understanding that when we're talking about the foreign affairs context may actually warrant judicial deference, thereby, again, kind of foreclosing where we go in the future. Finally, I should note there is a real question about what decisions to use or what the decision to use state law to meet treaty obligations signifies going forward. Does this mean that states are prohibited from changing state law if the U.S. has joined a treaty on the assumption that state law satisfies the treaty's obligations? Even Missouri v. Holland didn't go that far. So I think even if the future won't tell us definitively what federalism limits exist for the treaty power, I do think it's likely to show us who is going to be interested in federalism questions. And again, somewhat counterintuitively, my guess going forward is that it will continue to be the executive that will inform that analysis more than the traditional choice between Congress and the courts that the debate between political and judicial safeguards of federalism has long assumed was the choice we were talking about. So thank you.
Thank you, Duncan. Okay, well, I'm going to invoke my prerogative here, since we're a smaller panel anyways, to offer a few comments on both, first on Duncan's point, mostly to endorse, and then a few thoughts on the delegation point, and then raise a few questions. I think I agreed with Duncan. I think this is the important phenomenon that a lot of scholars haven't focused on properly, is the role of the president and actually the State Department Legal Advisor's Office, but also the Department of Justice and other entities within the government in sort of creating the rules that treaties are going to be, how they're going to be implemented. And so they do tend to be an important choke point for any federalism limitations. And what I want to suggest, though, is that I think we saw an increasing trend in the, at least in the past administration, maybe even in prior administrations, a slow consensus that for certain kinds of treaties that would have a potentially disruptive effects on state law, that first and foremost, there are two devices that there was a pretty broad consensus on, I believe, and I might be mistaken. One is that, and this is going back to David and John's discussion as well, one is the importance of a non-self-execution declaration, that the executive would impose, or at least request that the Senate impose, it's a shared, I think, usually a shared decision, to impose a non-self-execution declaration or a condition on the advice and consent of the Senate, so that both the executive and the Senate would have essentially expressed the view that this treaty is going to, we're going to give advice and consent, we're going to ratify it, but it shall be non-self-executing. This is a trend that began in the 1980s, or actually the early 1990s with the major international human rights treaties, and I think has actually continued with some more recent treaties in the past 10 years, and this is part of the basis for Duncan's work, is to notice that the executive has used a non-self-execution declaration combined with federalism understandings that are attached to these documents, or even federalism sort of reservations, to try to protect the states. And so the states, the president does in fact have an important role and can really be the most important and most effective protector of state power. Now, what I'm kind of curious about is whether or not there's a consensus here, at least a bureaucratic consensus, that this is the proper way to proceed. This actually, even the or during the Clinton administration, the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which is actually not a deeply controversial human rights treaty, was submitted by the Clinton administration with both a non-self-execution and a federalism understanding attached to it, which would have both limited the which would have effectively given it no domestic effect, at least that's their intent, and would have protected the states and would have been able to limit the effect on the states. What I'm interested in, and this is if you go forward looking, is whether this consensus, which I may be too hasty in calling consensus, within the bureaucracy and perhaps even, but which is not a consensus among legal scholars, that these sorts of, this approach is a good way to manage and accommodate federalism concerns, whether this consensus will survive going forward. And the reason I think so, and you're right, I agree, it's too early to tell, but Harold Coe is a major critic of this approach. He has stated on a variety of occasions and has written that this is potentially unconstitutional, but certainly bad policy. And so that's why I'm a little skeptical. I'd be surprised that we will see him endorsing these, and that's part of his responsibility, endorsing this, what I think is a consensus approach that does result in the protection of federalism by the executive. But I'm not sure how this will sort of churn out through the policy process in the government. But for the first time, we have some of the scholarly critics of non-self-execution in the administration who I think can influence the decision-making on this. And so although I don't want to offer predictions because I have know little about how this works, this is an important flashpoint. If the administration, when they do submit some of the major, when they do submit the treaty, new treaties to, well, if they also endorse the non-self-execution federalism combo that both the Bush-Clinton-Bush administrations used, then we'll see a consensus developing. If they don't, which I think is still possible, then I think we'll see a potential shift here, and I think a slight breakdown, which suggests maybe that there's a political sort of contingency to your thesis that the president is institutionally the one who's always going to be interested in protecting the states. Although I definitely agree that the president is best positioned in many ways in our modern system to protect the states from treaties. And this leads me to sort of my broader comment on the delegation discussion, which is non-self-execution seems to be really what people are often worried about in the delegation context, although that's not the only thing Or actually, I should put it the other way. Self-execution is what people are often worried about, or direct effect is what people are worried about in a delegation context. So the concern is, to phrase it in sort of the most paranoid way I can come up with, we give these sort of greedy UN bureaucrats the power to make American law. That wasn't a very good Pappy Cannon imitation. Let me try that again. But the idea here would be that you're turning over the power to affect Americans, right, within the United States legal system. You're turning it to some faceless international bureaucracy. We don't even like our faceless American bureaucracy, but we like, or perhaps our fear, our faceless international one, perhaps even more, maybe unjustifiably, but we definitely fear them, perhaps even more. And that's, I think, but it seems to me that's why non-self-execution is an important point here. It seems that it does seem, and I've argued in some articles, that this is the more important way, maybe not more important, but just as important as the method by which we enter into the agreements, is to ensure that there is a non-self-execution limitation on these delegations, so that, contrary to David's loss, the non-self-execution doctrine would then allow us to enter into the international agreements, but to allow us also to control and limit the way in which these delegations are implemented domestically. So John's work is focused on more how do we get into these delegations. But it seems to me the non-self-execution point is crucial for what many people are worried about, which is the actual, when you delegate power to the national institution, everything's happy in the beginning, right? It's wonderful, they'll do great things. But then you don't know. The delegation is what we fear is that they'll do something we didn't think that they would do, and they'll screw things up, and that it wasn't what we wanted them to do or what we thought they would do. And so we need some way to stop, to check them, and the non-self-execution was at least a way to shield the domestic legal system. Under John's proposal, that wouldn't change. It would simply be harder to get into the delegation, but it wouldn't necessarily police the delegation on the back end. And I don't believe he makes the argument that we need a robust non-self-execution understanding. In fact, it might be the opposite. And Dave is arguing that once you enter in the delegation, at least state courts and federal officers are automatically bound, regardless, perhaps, even of what the Senate or the President say when they ratify this treaty. It seems like the concern about delegations we're going to have is the faceless international bureaucrat telling Americans what to do without any ability to stop them. And neither the proposal of going through the treaty process or going through the or especially treating all of them as self-executing or having direct effect is likely to exacerbate that problem. And as a political matter, frankly, discourage entering into these international institutions. Now, I should say that there, of course, are delegations that largely don't impact our domestic law. You could delegate, for instance, powers which are really within the realm of the president, say decisions on with respect to foreign affairs, right? So, decisions on whether or not a delegation in the context of arms control, or perhaps in the context of military movements where the president has sole discretion anyway, or mostly on movement. What's at stake in the delegation battle is this domestic effect. So I wonder and worry, especially for John, whether the treaty process and his reliance on the supermajority treaty process really necessarily solves all the concerns. So non-self-execution seems to be an important point. I'm also not totally persuaded by the fact that the treaty clause, just because Alexander Hamilton said you could do whatever you wanted through the treaty clause to obviate structural constraints otherwise applicable by the Constitution, that we can be so confident the treaty clause is necessarily a sufficient solution. You might imagine that, although the Jay Treaty might be one example, a counterexample, that with respect to substantial, serious changes to our structural system, what we really need is a constitutional amendment, like some other countries have done in order to bring themselves into greater compliance with international sort of systems. Of course, that does seem kind of difficult. And talk about supermajority, right? That's like super, super, super majority. But it might be that's a possible alternative way if we wanted to really talk seriously about process as a way of policing the international delegations process. Okay, so what I want to do now is we actually have a fair amount of time. So I wanted actually to allow each of the panelists to respond to my comments, and then each of them has the opportunity to ask questions of their other panelists if they if they have any. So we'll start with John. Since he's...
Okay, let me make two points. First, actually, about the federalism point. I think what your comments raise is, are there structural reasons the president is more likely to protect federalism? And I think there may be such structural reasons, including the president's actual greater need to have state officials, thinking about his reelection, his party's reelection. Moreover, the president, I think, actually has perhaps more interest in jurisdictional competition than other actors, because that leads to economic growth. But that, I think, raises the interesting explanation. Is there some structural explanation that goes beyond politics? With respect to self-execution, well, certainly I don't want to be misunderstood. I do not agree, and I don't want to go into great length, because I don't think it makes so much difference to the future. I certainly think that there can be you don't have to have self-executing treaties. You cannot have self-executing treaties and make these matters just a matter of international obligation. The difficulty with that, as I suggest, though, is without direct effect, we're not going to get direct effect from others as well. And for all the reasons, if there are actual externalities, it may be impossible to go and negotiate things quickly enough to do that, to address real issues in the modern world. Is the supermajority of the treaty sufficient? Well, I think it may be, because, of course, people will understand those costs, the costs of delegation, and they will negotiate for constraints in light of the supermajority, in the shadow of that supermajority. It's going to be hard to get a supermajority of the Senate to delegate matter to, as you put it, faceless international bureaucrats. That's a pretty good slogan, I think. I think that's a pretty substantial, and I think it's important to note, we haven't been doing a lot of international delegations of direct effect. And in fact, the one time, the biggest delegation of direct effect we now have is under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And that was precisely done under a congressional agreement, which would not be legal under my system. You'd have to go through a treaty, but it certainly could not have gotten the two-thirds vote in the Senate. So that, I think, has much more substantial bite as a practical matter. I'm quite confident, as you know, there are a lot of scholars who are very worried that the two-thirds requirement of the Senate will make it impossible to enter into, quite the opposite, these international delegations with direct effect. I'm less worried about that because there are these costs. There are these agency costs. There are these democratic costs in which I think that has a substantial counterbalance. So I do think it is a substantial constraint, as evidenced by our not entering into many of these, but still giving the opportunity to enter them into when there are really really substantial reasons to do so, which there may be for global climate matters and for other kinds of matters in the future.
David?
All right. So I guess I want to say they do included the declaration saying the treaty is self-executing, so explicitly saying it's self-executing. For 7 of the 78, they had a declaration saying it's not self-executing. And in 2, for some reason, they didn't include a declaration either way. I'm not sure why. So the bulk of them, though, they're saying it's self-executing. And consistent with Duncan's point, this is all driven by the executive. Basically, the executive said, you ought to label this one this way, you ought to label this one this way. And the Senate did exactly what the executive recommended. So that's sort of consistent, I think, with your thesis. But the other point to make about these, though, is that if you look at which treaties they said are not self-executing, it's hard to read any of these as actually protecting the states or protecting federalism concerns. What these non-self-executing declarations are doing, the only treaties they apply them to are ones where the federal executive is worried that it's going to be a defendant in a lawsuit brought by a private party. And so this is the federal executive's way of immunizing itself from judicial decisions that hold the federal executive accountable or potentially hold the federal executive accountable for treaty violations. So it's all basically they're looking at which ones may come back to bite us if somebody sues on the basis of this treaty. So I don't see a whole lot of this, at least, and this is just, you know, this is 1 year, a very active year, but 1 year of what's going on, and they don't seem to be using it for federalism purposes. I guess two other points that, maybe really one other point that I wanted wanted to make, and this is this may be a point that John and I can debate a little bit, or we may have to do it offline. But he's referring to delegations that have direct effect. I was referring to delegations that are legally binding on the United States as a matter of international law. And I would say the understanding among those who negotiate these treaties is the question whether it is legally binding on the country, whether accepting a binding obligation is a question that is governed by international law and is subject to negotiation among the parties. Whether it has direct effect, and he may be using the term in a slightly different way than I'm understanding it, but whether it has a direct effect is a question of domestic law that is not subject to negotiation among the parties. It is governed by domestic law. That's the way virtually every other country in the world looks at this issue. So the idea that we're going to go out there and negotiate with others about what has direct effect, I think, is misunderstanding the line here between domestic and international law. International law says whether it's binding on us. And then how it's applied domestically is a question for the U.S. to decide for itself and is not a subject of negotiation among the parties. That being said, I think John and I actually agree that the critical issue here is when are you going to give an international institution authority to make decisions that are binding on the United States? There's a very limited number of cases where we do that, and there are good reasons why there are a limited number of cases where we do that. Although I think we're going to see more of those coming up in the future, and that's partly why this is important.
Duncan?
Sure. I kind of want to build off the two previous comments and kind of responding to you, Julie. I think one of the things that gets lost in this issue is that it's about compliance, right? Is that from the international law perspective, when the U.S. enters into these treaties, the question is, what do we need to do to comply? And so a lot of times what happens is the U.S., often the executive branch, looks at this and says, well, you know, we don't need the treaty to have direct domestic effect to comply. So on the human rights treaties, it wasn't that the U.S. joined these treaties and said, well, we want to tell the world, we want to signal the world that we're joining, have a nice signaling effect, but we're not going to have any direct domestic effect. It was that they'd gone through and said, you know, we can comply under existing federal, state, and constitutional provisions. We don't need this treaty to have direct domestic effect, but the idea is that there's still compliance. So I think one of the real questions going forward is, and this may be your point, is when we're talking about delegation and when we're talking about non-self-execution, there's kind of a background question of what's the effect on choice A or choice B between self-executing and non-self-executing, or between delegating with direct domestic effect or not delegating without direct domestic effect on that question of compliance. Because I think particularly, again, kind of, I guess I've become the voice of the executive informally. nothing I say should be attributed to my former government position, you know, all that. But I think there's this real question of, I think a lot of it is triggered by where the compliance answer comes out. And so I think what the response I wanted to make both to John and David's point was that not only do I think that there's – I agree with you that there are actually presently very few true international delegations, particularly in the way you've framed it, John. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be asking these questions. But I think what's very interesting is to see how often the United States views the correction for an international delegation is to give the U.S. either an opt-in or an opt-out or give the executive branch some voice. So I would say most of the international delegations in there have either a U.S. veto, have an opt-out where the United States can say, yes, you've adopted that decision, but we're going to back away, or some other way in which the United States has ensured that there's an executive branch decision between the international delegation and domestic effect. Medellin, in some ways, as difficult as some of the other reasoning the court makes, it seems consistent with that sort of approach. And even on NAFTA, I think what's interesting is that if you look, I believe the implementing legislation on NAFTA has a severability clause. And what that severability clause says, if any provision, say the binational panels, which so bother you, John, are declared unconstitutional, the fallback is the president has the authority to accept, is authorized by Congress to accept a binational panel decision, thereby making it federal law. So in some ways, I think we want to think about this in terms of compliance, and then also, you know, what does it mean to have the executive so constantly thinking the solution to the problem is simply to have an executive voice that can forestall the agreement having direct domestic effect, because that alone hasn't necessarily been satisfactory in the domestic context.
I can't resist that last point. If I might just point out that provision, that fallback severability provision, which came out first in the Canadian free trade agreement, was something I thought up on a plane ride in a shuttle from Washington to New York. So I'm very happy to claim ownership
on it. Lives
this 20 years later.
Wow, that's legislative history.
In future, we will call this the McGinnis Amendment.
Yeah. I guess, let me just, one quick point on what's fascinating, though, to me. I think the reason why I keep coming back to non-self-execution as the important flashpoint is that what's fascinating to me is the debates about some of the more controversial treaties. Like, I was looking at the CEDAW committee hearings, the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and one of the chief advocates for it, Senator Barbara Boxer, said this is a really important treaty. And it's non-self-executing, so it will require no changes in domestic law. So the opponents of the treaty, their position is not that we don't believe we should eliminate discrimination against women. They believe that it would actually require changes in domestic law. And that's why that was the basis for opposing it. It would get rid of Mother's Day, et cetera, et cetera. So what's weird about it, it seems like the effect domestically is the flashpoint. And the non-self-execution declaration is a way to sort of say to the rest of the world, we're complying, because we are complying. But they're not. But it's also purely to claim that we're not actually going to have to change our domestic law. And there's important domestic political reasons for doing that. And that's why I think it's useful also in the context of the delegations. One delegation that has been relatively uncontroversial, I think, maybe despite the protests in the streets and stuff like that. The WTO delegations are relatively big, and I presume John would say technically unconstitutional.
Because they're under international law.
Because there's no direct effect on it. So it seems like the self-execution doctrine would solve our problem here. When the WTO says U.S. is not in compliance, which they do fairly frequently, it almost always requires, who's it go to? Because it almost always goes to Congress, except in a few cases, or the executive. But in many cases, it goes to Congress and to come up with compliance. And this isn't actually all that terrible. All the other countries, including Europe, have the same system. They actually have to go back to their legislative processes to deal with it. So that seems to me, that actually is both the way that many countries could deal with delegations. It is actually considered one of the more successful international systems for cooperation, although there's some controversy on that point. And it seems like that's a strong argument in favor of that system, rather than going for broke and claiming that we can do direct effect as long as we do it through the treaty process.
I think the WTO is very successful in that way, but I do think there are some structures in the WTO that make this successful. The way WTO compliance and what gets Congress to comply and other nations to comply in relatively short order are the sanctions that are able to be levied by others on exporting industries, right? When Bush, here's an example, when Bush decided to do a variety of things on the steel industry for West Virginia, and he was ruled to be illegal under the WTO, what the European nations were able to do was to impose sanctions on orange growers in Florida, all of these marginal states, which Bush actually needed for his reelection. And so that structure, of course, got the Bush's attention and Congress's attention to change. I don't think that all of our future international delegations are going to have that happy structure of having a way of orienting business to be, in some sense, the informal enforcer of a pretty rapid enforcer of international agreements. So I'm not sure, as much as I like the WTO enforcement and how ingenious, in some sense, the informal structure of it is, I'm not sure it is a template for all international delegations in the future.
Can I add one thing actually about WTO, and it applies to NAFTA too, and it's interesting and it ties back into the federalism issue, but notice that, like under WTO or NAFTA, if it's a state law that is putting us in noncompliance, who's responsible for dealing that? The president can bring suit against the state and get a court order compelling the state to comply with, you know, the decision of whatever it is, right? But if it is a federal law that that is putting us in noncompliance, you need Congress, right? So so it actually gives the president and the courts a significant role in enforcing these against the states. But if it's a federal law, you got to go back to Congress and get Congress to change the law, right?
Yeah, no, and I think that's, I mean, to me that's a decent template, but maybe for the reasons John suggested, maybe not sufficiently effective template. But it seems like a fruitful template for future international cooperation. And we could have consensus on that, I think, where there might be some consensus on that going forward. All right, let me open this up now to questions from the audience. We've kind of plumbed some of these issues, but I would love to hear from you guys.
A very broad debate, but I just thought maybe you could sort of come in a little bit and explain sort of, I take it your position was that non-self-executing treaties are not constitutional except in cases where they require, I mean, I'm not even sure what this other category was, but if you could kind of explain where that's coming from, where the exception's coming from, why an intent to make a non-self-executing treaty, you made some reference to that at the end, before, why that would be unconstitutional?
It depends what you mean by non-self-executing is part of the problem, because the term is means different things in different contexts, right? But the understanding that I maintain prevailed actually from the founding up until the 1960s was that there are two categories of non-self-executing treaties. One is a treaty that obligates the United States to take steps that fall within the scope of Congress's exclusive powers under Article I. That is, for example, a treaty that obligates us to appropriate funds, right? If it obligates us to appropriate funds, only Congress can do that because the Constitution gives that power to Congress, right? Second category of non-self-executing treaties is treaties that could be implemented by the executive but not by the courts because they're basically too vague, right? They lay down some kind of obligation, but it's so hard to figure out what the obligation is that we have this sense of it's beyond the bounds of judicial discretion to take that and sort of try and apply it. So you had a bunch of litigation starting in the 1950s where people wanted to get the courts to enforce the human rights provisions of the UN Charter. But what do the human rights provisions of the UN Charter say? They say, take steps to promote human rights, right? And and people are trying to get the courts to rule on that basis. Well, this particular California law, which says this, is invalid because it conflicts with the treaty. And the courts, I think, rightly said, look, that's not our job. We can't take this vague general language, promote human rights, and translate that into a specific rule that, you know, and use that to invalidate a California law, right? Notice that neither of these have anything to do with the treaty maker's intent about the domestic effects of treaties, right? The first is a matter of constitutional limits on parties other than Congress or where certain powers fall exclusively to Congress, right? The second is about limits on courts that have to do with the sort of nature of the judicial function. But neither of these ideas or doctrines hinge on what did the treaty makers intend about domestic implementation at the time they adopted the treaty. That idea came along really in the 1960s, and it was a novel idea that the treaty makers actually can make this choice, right, about implementation. What's the choice? So what is the choice we think they're making when they say a treaty is non-self-executing? Well, if you take a narrow view of that, I actually don't have a problem with it. The narrow view is it imposes some limits on judicial enforcement, but it doesn't bar judicial enforcement altogether. That's consistent with what Congress does in a lot of statutes, right? The bigger problem is this, that the way a lot of people read these non-self-executing declarations is we are undertaking a binding international legal obligation, right, that we will comply with this treaty, whatever the treaty says, right? We undertake a binding obligation, we will comply with the treaty. there are constitutional provisions out there that require the president to carry that out under Article 2, require state courts to carry that out under Article 6. And if you read that declaration to override Article 2 and Article 6, I think you've got a problem. You can't have a declaration by the Senate saying the president shall not take clear that this treaty is executed. You cannot have a declaration by the Senate saying state courts are not bound. Now, there are a lot of cases where state courts aren't bound, you know, because they don't have jurisdiction over the case. That's another issue, right? But I don't see that a declaration can basically override the provision in the Constitution that says state courts are bound to apply this. So if there's a case where state court actually has jurisdiction, you have a treaty that applies to the case, somebody's saying the treaty requires this outcome and state law requires a different outcome, that is precisely the situation that the Supremacy Clause addresses, and it gives the courts a constitutional duty to apply the treaty, and I don't think you can opt out of that through a non-self-executing declaration.
Sure. I warned you about the self-execution thing. He knows more about it than we've forgotten.
The basic premise of the response is that the treaty people can't override the Constitution, but you might alternatively think of it as not overriding the Constitution, but just making a different content for the treaty. So if the treaty says, look, our obligation is to enforce this and it shall be enforced by congressional legislation, then there's no violation of the treaty. The treaty itself limits itself. So I mean, it begs the question to say you're overriding the Constitution.
Okay, so I don't want to go into too much of a back and forth here, but the treaty says what the international obligation is. The treaty doesn't say who carries that out domestically. And specifically, the treaty doesn't prohibit particular domestic actors from carrying out the treaty. No treaty has ever done that, okay? We have never had a treaty that actually says you must do X, but so-and-so may not do X, right? You must do X, but this particular actor in the domestic legal system may not do that, right? So, no, there has never actually been a treaty where there is a conflict between what the treaty says and what the Supremacy Clause says, although there are lots of judicial decisions who think that that's what's going on, but insofar as they interpret the treaty that way, they're simply wrong. It's not what the treaty says.
So I don't want to follow. It's a quick point. So basically what you're saying is that if they put it in the treaty, you know, if you think that's okay, that would be okay. It's different that they do these reservations.
Right.
That are not part of the treaty.
Right. But the problem is that when you're – particularly in the multilateral context – is, you know, you've got the French system where all treaties have domestic effect if they're published. The British, no treaty has domestic effect unless Parliament implements it. So as a practical matter – You're not going to be able to get that text into the negotiation in any multilateral context because the domestic systems are so different. And that was a point that was raised in Medellin, for example, is when the court says you got to look to the treaty for the intent of whether or not it's supposed to have direct domestic effect. That seems to be counterintuitive because there's such a variety of national systems on that question of how they effectuate treaties.
And the background rule of international law that is understood by all treaty negotiators is that the question of who within the domestic legal system executes the treaty is a question of domestic law, not a question of international law, and therefore it's not something that's subject to negotiation among the parties. Now, you can find a couple of exceptions in bilateral treaties where there are sort of specific negotiations. You can't find any exception in multilateral treaties. It's just they don't do it.
Maybe we should. I want to say something, but I won't. Any other questions? Or we can. We're almost done. I think we're done, maybe we'll just close up then and thank our I told you we'd get back to self-execution because I made us do that. I think it is at the core of this. Thank you very much. Thank our panelists very much.
Thank you.